Hello and welcome to episode number 191 of the Felby.
Of the what? Felby?
Hello and welcome to episode number 191 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from... Oh boy, I'm all off now.
Wow, third time. We haven't even drank this cherry choctabulous yet.
No, this is completely sober. Hello and welcome to episode number 191 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
Hello! The division round playing Seattle Seahawks.
That's what we're about. In a playoff preview week for the Seahawks, for the six out of Russell Wilson's eight seasons, we are previewing a game in the second round of the playoffs against the hated Green Bay Packers.
I thought that was going to be Rodgers in particular.
It's the whole team.
Fair. We're going to get to that. We got a lot to get to. Busy week is always in Seattle sports. Should we start with toasts?
Absolutely, we should.
A toast.
I've got a question for you, a food-related question after this.
Okay. What are we drinking here?
We are drinking from our good friends at Rogue Brewing Company in maybe Eugene, maybe Portland, Oregon.
No. It's on the coast.
On the coast?
Yeah.
Newport, Oregon.
Yeah.
From our good friends at Rogue Brewery in from Newport, Oregon.
I mean, they have the brew house in Portland, but that Rogue is not the headquarters.
Cherry Choctabulous. Milk stout with natural cherry and chocolate flavors.
I picked this up for our Christmas Eve party. It was not drinking. I don't know what the past participle there is at the Christmas Eve party. So we had it left over for the pod. I'm excited about this one, though.
I was too busy drinking the Kylo Ren hard kombuchas.
I was too busy getting iced. I'm 37 years old.
You were iced. You know, Chris Smith got iced twice on Christmas Eve.
Wait, what?
Christmas Eve was a time of icing. So he got iced.
I mean, Christmas Eve.
You need to work iced in there somewhere. He got iced earlier on in the night. And granted, this was a heavy night of drinking for him. But then he got to his bed. He was staying at a cabin somewhere on Whidbey Island. And he got to his bed. And there was a Smirnoff Ice waiting in his bed for him. And he drank it like a pro. He got down on one damn knee and drank it in one gulp. Much faster than you did at the very end of the night of drinking.
So I ended up throwing up a little bit.
Did you?
On Christmas Eve night. Yeah. Got very sick to my stomach.
When? On Christmas Day?
Like during the middle of the night.
Really?
Yeah.
Just from drinking one Smirnoff Ice?
That's what I blame you on, because I didn't eat that much.
I'm kind of surprised by this.
So I'm putting a kibosh on this tradition. This is not becoming a thing.
Wow.
I'm preventing it from becoming a thing.
I mean, maybe for you, but I would gladly be iced.
Okay. You're welcome getting iced.
Yeah, just bring it on, Santa Claus. Whatever you'd like. Anyway. We got
only on Christmas Eve, though.
Dedicated, the Cherry Choctabulous, is dedicated to guilty pleasures. Cherry Choctabulous opens up gushing with luscious cherry aroma and flavor that quickly gives way to indulgent notes of rich dark chocolate. A delicious treat any time of year, but we particularly enjoy it on a crisp winter evening such as today.
There you go.
And this one pairs well with, are you eating this right now? Any of these? Truffle fries?
No.
Not on the podcast?
No.
Roast duck?
No.
Okay, this one you're definitely currently eating. A chocolate-covered banana?
No. Are any of these Wendy's spicy chicken nuggets?
Sauce.
Indora frosting?
They're saying pairing something with a chocolate-covered banana. It's like pair it with something that you would eat one time in your entire life. All right, let's crack this puppy open. All right. Toast.
So we only have one toast this week. But it's a good one.
It's a singular toast.
Two. UW inside linebacker Edifuan Ulofosio, who, did you see this video?
No.
He was a walk-on, earned a scholarship as a starter through the stretch run of last season in the Las Vegas Bowl. And the Huskies posted the video of Jimmy Lake announcing this in front of the team at their first meeting of the spring quarter on Monday. And, you know, he's mobbed by teammates. Everyone's so happy for him. So one of those great moments in college sports.
All right.
So there you go. Congrats, Eddie.
That one tastes like the system still being broken.
I'm not going to deny that one. Well, let's get into sports, and let's start with our NBA Seattle update, sponsored by our friends Pagliacci Pizza.
Because Pagliacci wants basketball back in Seattle, and so do we.
So I don't know that I have a lot of updates this week. Carmelo Anthony hit a game winner for the Blazers earlier tonight. That was pretty exciting. Gary Payton II had his contract guaranteed. Today was the deadline. If players were on the roster beyond today, their contracts become guaranteed for the rest of the season. So GP2's sticking around with the Wizards. Marquese Chris not sticking with the Golden State Warriors.
Really?
Yeah, despite the fact that he'd played quite well, they decided to waive him because they needed to clear room under the hard cap they're dealing with to sign Damian Lee, who's been on a two-way contract for them and is running out of days on his two-way.
Should we anticipate Marquese Chris signing somewhere else?
I mean, there's definitely a good chance of him signing a 10-day. A lot of teams are leaving roster spots open up until the trade deadline. So I think it's unlikely that he'll get a
every
full NBA
every team is leaving a roster spot open just for Andre Iguodala.
Not necessarily Andre Iguodala, but I think it's the possibility of making an imbalanced trade where, you know, you take back a couple of players and send out one, for example. So a bit of a bummer. Chris played well in Golden State, but not terribly surprising because of their roster and hard cap crunch. That was kind of, you know, unless they were able to trade one of the veterans on the roster, it looked like that was going to happen. And maybe that will eventually happen. Maybe they'll trade Alec Burks and clear room for Chris to return that way.
Guess we'll see. I mean, there's going to be a lot of transactions starting to happen.
I hope so. Need some grades to trade.
You have not graded so anything.
Some trades to grade. The Dante Exum, Jordan Clarkson swap last month.
Yeah.
That ended the dry spell.
It'd been a long... You're like a teacher who's been on hiatus, right?
Something like that.
You went on...
Sabbatical?
Yeah, you went on sabbatical.
I mean, I still continue to work.
Do you remember how to grade things anymore?
I do.
How are you grading this podcast so far?
It's not getting high marks.
Solid F. Okay.
Oh, dear. Continuing this poorly graded podcast, an update on the NHL Seattle front on a story that at first does not seem to relate to them, which is that the Nashville Predators, or Preds for a period of time with third brother Reese, fired head coach Peter LaViolette on Monday night. So why is this relevant to Seattle? Well, because...
Wait. So why is this relevant to Seattle?
Great stuff. Because of the fact that he coached Ron Francis
trying to get up to a D-minus
in Carolina during the NHL Seattle GM's final season 2003-04. He subsequently led the Hurricanes to the 2006 Stanley Cup and has since led both Philadelphia in 2010 and Nashville in that thrilling 2017 run to the Stanley Cup Finals. The Preds had won their division in the previous 2 years without getting back to the Western Conference Finals, and he was fired with the team outside the playoff picture right now in a bit of a downturn for them. But his 637 career wins ranked seventh among active coaches, so pretty immediately there was speculation that this could be the first head coach for NHL Seattle.
All right, bring it on, Peter LaViolette.
I mean, we've heard names before, but now we're getting to the point where it's more realistic because at that point it was like, you know, the summer.
There was definitely a coach who had to like take a year off, literally go on sabbatical.
Yes, that would be what would happen here. Yes.
But this makes a lot more sense.
Now we're only a year and a half out. It's not as big of a deal, especially if you don't think he's going to get another job this season. Then it's only 1 year that he's actually out.
My goal is to get a job that I start in a year and a half.
I mean, there's scouting. There's things going on, but it is a pretty great gig, all things considered.
Well, I guess here's to hoping that Peter LaViolette gets that great opportunity.
Good for you, Peter. Let's skip ahead to UW men's basketball, which opened Pac-12 play last weekend in confounding fashion, I'd say, starting on Thursday with a 66-64 loss to slumping UCLA, and then bouncing back on Sunday by blowing out USC 72-40 to even their record at 1-1 in conference play. So which of these games reflect the Huskies we can expect to see going forward?
And well, let's just, can we just for a second here?
We can for a second.
That UCLA game was ridiculous.
You didn't see that Jake Kaiman was going to hit seven three-pointers, I should say, including the game winner?
I'm sorry, but like...
four in his career previously as a freshman?
And they were open shots, a lot of them. But even then, he still shouldn't have hit that many shots. This was so Husky basketball. It doesn't matter who the coach is.
Incredible Husky basketball.
It's just like, there's always going to be a white guy you've never heard of to hit seven threes against you. Does this happen to other teams? Other teams have those players?
I don't know. We have to check with fans of another team to see if this happens.
You know Gonzaga's not like, oh, some white guy hits seven threes against us all the time.
I feel like that's if they're going to lose, that's how it's going to be in West Coast Conference play. I was feeling slightly better about the fact that UW was playing so poorly in the first half. They were down 10 at halftime because Gonzaga trailed Portland at halftime on Thursday night, but they unsurprisingly came back to win.
Winning comfortably. And but this was UCLA, who you'd sort of prepped us on as being a terrible three-point shooting team.
Correct.
And one of the worst teams in the Pac-12. And it was just like, the Huskies are going to get it back. The Huskies are going to get it back. They're going to get it back. Jaden McDaniels sort of like ridiculously fouls out of the game with a couple minutes into the second half. Whereas like, there are some of these calls, which I'm sorry.
The first two calls were borderline at best.
That should be the nickname for Pac-12 officiating.
Borderline at best.
Like, can we just not? Why does this happen in the Pac-12 and not in other conferences? Fucking problem?
I don't think it doesn't happen in other conferences. I don't know if you're aware of this. College basketball players do tend to foul out regularly throughout the NCAA.
Just the ticky-tack fouls, where it's just like, why? Why are you calling this? Why do you need to call back? Even when it benefits the Huskies, I still hate it.
Yeah.
It just sucks.
It does.
It sucks watching. People don't like seeing fouls.
But now, in fairness, people also don't like seeing, you know, this is like the James Harden complaint when the heckler yelled at him a few weeks ago, like, nobody came here to watch you shoot free throws. And he was like, well, nobody came here to see me get fouled and not called either. So, you know, if you don't call anything, then that does create problems. But his first foul in particular, which was him and another player just going for a loose ball for a rebound and colliding in midair, it was not clear which of the two players initiated the contact. It wasn't significant contact. That's the one that you just let go. And I was like watching an NBA game a couple days later, and it was like an identical play, and I was like, that was nothing, because that's how it is in the NBA, and the basketball is better there. Now, Jaden...
obviously, like... refereeing is better in the NBA. It's obviously not perfect. But, like, the ones that bother me are just for no reason affect the flow of the basketball game fouls. And those are the ones where it's like, there's no contact. Nobody anywhere saw there be a foul. But the referees were just like, ah, there's a foul. And it just gets tacked on to the player, and it means that one of the potential lottery picks in this game didn't get to play in the game. And you're just like, who is this for? What are you doing this for? Are you making it a cleaner game? Are you making the game flow better? Literally, you're doing nothing by doing this.
I mean, look,
Also, having technical fouls count as personal fouls. Why? Why?
Well, probably to discourage players from getting technical fouls. And Jaden McDaniels getting a technical foul from the bench is something that, during timeout, is something that basically never happens. And that's on Jaden. Like, you got to be smarter than that. His fifth foul was a play where, you know, he contested a shot in transition. It was a legitimate foul. He knew that there was a good chance of picking up his fifth foul. There was 15 minutes left in the game. You just can't make that play because the Huskies need you out on the court, and that was evident over the rest of the game. I mean,
they missed Jaden. I think we saw the value of Jaden McDaniels in this game.
For sure, and it was
might
a
have
case
been
where...
underrating him beforehand and his what he does, especially defensively on the court, because they looked bad defensively.
Yeah, and a lot of that was Kaiman making shots, but you know, Chris Smith had a surprisingly good game for UCLA. They were strong on the offensive glass.
Bounced back after getting iced so many times.
We saw McDaniel's value defensively also in the USC game, where he had 5 blocks in the first 10 minutes of that game, finished with 6. Like, the Trojans just kept trying to bring him inside on him, and he was like, yeah, I'm just going to keep blocking this. Okay, cool.
He's got long arms.
See how this works out for you. And it did not work out for USC, which scored 40 points again in that game. So, yeah, I mean, UW had been down by 10, I think, at halftime, had rallied pretty quickly to close that gap and take the lead in the second half. It was a sellout crowd at Heck Ed. The fans were rocking, and it just never got them over the hump. I mean, they also, you know, it seemed like they were going to win. They went up 1 on the Naz Carter play late in the game.
Oh, man. When he hit that 3, it was like, oh, no, 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 okay.
And then Kaiman answers with a 3 at the other end, and Carter turned the ball over on their final possession, and that was that.
I mean, UCLA, for being one of the worst offenses in the Pac-12, every single time they needed a bucket, got it.
I mean, the thing about UCLA is, compared to like playing a non-conference team, is, look, these are all still great athletes. These are all still highly recruited players. They just haven't played well together this season. But they had the size to deal with UW.
That's the other tagline of the Pac-12. These are all still great athletes. They just don't play well together.
I mean, the other thing that happened in the Pac-12 this weekend is everyone went 1-1 except for the teams that played their rivals.
Why does this happen?
Whatever. Colorado beat Oregon, who then went and beat Utah after, and then Oregon State went in and beat Colorado. Like, it's just like
this is Pac-12 basketball.
UCLA subsequently lost in overtime.
Did they?
At Wazoo.
They lost to Wazoo.
They did.
Wow.
I mean, it's just, this is what the conference does, man.
Do you think that this game, and not to get too far away from sort of the statistical perspective of it, was this a bit of a wake up call for the Huskies, though?
I think so. And they also had been off for, you know, since the tournament they played, the Diamond Head Classic, over Christmas break. They had been off for like over a week at that point. It's not surprising that this happened, and it wouldn't have been a big deal.
It is surprising that it happened.
Yes, it is surprising that it's happened. But this happens to a lot of teams, and if they had won this game if Kaiman misses that last 3 and they win this 64-63, then you just say, okay, it's a learning experience, we move on. In this case, it's a learning experience that also could be detrimental for their NCAA tournament chances long term.
Maybe they needed the L, though, because
I preferred the no L.
Sure, of course. But like, they'd fucked around in the preseason and had played pretty badly against pretty bad teams in the first half, and then sort of just comfortably pulled away in the second half a lot. And I think they realized that this wasn't going to be the case here. And then on Sunday came out on Sunday night against a better USC team than
UCLA.
Really
good USC team.
And
they blew
them out of the water from the first second.
Yeah. I mean, USC couldn't score. Isaiah Stewart completely dominated his matchup against Onyeka Okongwu, the other lottery prospect in this game. Who ended up putting up some points and got a lot of rebounds, but just wasn't a presence at any point. Didn't seem to relish the physical challenge of matching up with Isaiah Stewart, who definitely relishes contact. He enjoys that. And Stewart was really good despite dealing with foul trouble in the first half. McDaniels couldn't make a shot, but was awesome defensively. And this was everything you would hope from the Huskies. So, you know, you hope that going forward, it's going to be a lot more like that than it was against UCLA. And now comes an interesting road trip this weekend as they head to the Bay Area to play at Stanford on Thursday and then Saturday at Cal. Stanford beat Cal in the Pac-12 opener for both teams, moving to 12-2 on the season. They're ranked number 51 in KenPom. And if you look at the Joe Lunardi ESPN bracketology, right now Stanford, one of the last 4 byes, is a 10 seed. The Huskies, one of the last 4 in, is an 11 in the play-in game. Stanford's 2 non-conference losses, both to top 10 teams. They lost at home to number 3 Kansas, and in a neutral site in Kansas City, the number 6 Butler by 1 point. They only played 1 other top 100 KenPom team in non-conference, beating Oklahoma by 19 in their first of the 2 games at the Sprint Center. And that tournament of sorts got a 16-point win over Cal in their Pac-12 opener. If you look at them statistically, number 12 in the nation so far in three-point percentage and also top 50 in two-point percentage, but their offense still isn't very good because they turn the ball over frequently and never get offensive rebounds. This team really under Jared Haas.
Okay, Jared Haas.
Yeah.
Who is that?
He was a star at Kansas, longtime assistant coach under Roy Williams.
Okay.
Excellent across the board defensively. They're 17th in adjusted defensive rating. No real weaknesses there. Even though they are pretty small, they start just one player listed at bigger than 200 pounds, that being junior center Oscar Da Silva, who's emerged as an NBA prospect. They're starting a pair of freshmen in guard Tyrell Terry and forward Spencer Jones, both of whom are hitting better than 40% from three. And Terry, in particular, is one of the nation's best freshmen thus far. Played himself onto the NBA's radar, and also shooting better than 40% from three so far is Dejon Davis. So the zone better be ready to extend out to the 3-point line in this one.
Oh boy.
And I think it is, but it'll be an interesting matchup.
I mean, definitely a huge game from what you're talking about. Two teams right there on the bubble in the Pac-12.
Yeah.
And like whoever ends up finishing higher in the Pac-12 between these two teams, if they stay sort of relatively in the same place, one team could be in and one team could be out.
Especially because, and then it's especially important because, you know, at this point, you'd expect Oregon, Colorado, and Arizona to be the top three teams in the Pac-12, which would leave UW and Stanford potentially fighting for that last bye in the Pac-12 tournament, not having to play on the opening night of that.
And it sounds like maybe Isaiah Stewart will be able to do some things down low.
I would think so, and especially if he can get Da Silva in foul trouble, that would be great news for the Huskies because they don't have a lot of quality size behind him.
But being able to stop good three-point shooters.
Always a question mark.
And the Huskies haven't even faced that many this season. A situation like this, they haven't really dealt with. And when they faced Jake Kiman last week, they weren't able to handle it.
Yeah, I mean, they've faced some quality shooting teams in non-conference, but those are going to be like really small, weaker opponents. The combination of that with some NBA caliber size and athleticism is a little different, you know, mix.
I mean, it's going to be the type of game where Jaden's going to have to be really smart and stay on the court. And, you know, keep his length on the court where he's going to disrupt those players.
An easier task for the Huskies on Saturday, where Cal is starting from scratch under new head coach and one-time UW assistant Mark Fox. They started the season...
So just... the Pac-12 college basketball coach, like, I could name, like, two of them now.
We'll maybe do that quiz later on.
Mark Fox?
Yeah.
Jared Haas?
Yeah.
You're making all of these up.
I'm not making these up. I don't know who would be the other Pac-12 coach you'd be least likely to know. Oh, Wazoo.
I was gonna guess Ernie Kent.
No, I saw Ernie Kent at the Blazers game the last time I was
is
down
Jordan
there.
Jordan Kent still on the broadcast?
Jordan Kent is still on the broadcast. Yes.
Who is Wazoo's coach?
Kyle Smith, who was at San Francisco last year, replaced Ernie Kent.
Definitely made up.
The other coaches you should know. All the other coaches have been there a long period of time.
You'd be surprised.
Do you like not know who ASU's coach is? Well, I guess other than UCLA, but we went over that one.
ASU? I have no idea.
It's Bobby Hurley. Come on.
Oh, yeah, Bobby Hurley. Okay.
What, do you not even know Colorado's coach?
Tad Doyle.
Boyle. That's close enough. I'll give you that one.
Okay.
You know Andy Enfield, right?
I knew that he came from Florida Gulf Coast. I don't know if I Dunk could City. Necessarily come up with his name.
Is for Cal under Mark Fox.
You know, and
it was a rough go for them the last couple of years with Wyking Jones. They're basically starting over. They begin the season 4-0, but have since lost 8 of their last 10 to drop to nearly 200 in KenPom.
Wow.
They have not beaten a top 100.
Also, can I ask you, what? It seems like Stanford has had a very good season, right?
Yes.
Their two losses have been...
Well, they beat up on a lot of lesser competition.
That's what a good team does. That's the description of a good KenPom team.
Well, I don't know if they beat up. Sorry, they were victorious against a lot of lesser KenPom competition.
How are they number 51 in KenPom? Like, do you think that he's devaluing the Pac-12 a little bit too much?
I mean, there's not like a Pac-12 variable, so... I don't think so. I mean, they started really low as part of it, so that will take a long time to catch up. They started 92 coming into the season.
Is the preseason ranking factored too much into it? Because people care about these KenPom ratings.
Probably not, because if you look at, you know, Ken posted this on Twitter a few weeks ago, like the teams that had raised their rankings the most from the start of the season to the end of basically non-conference play, and those teams didn't necessarily like keep improving their ranking once conference play started. A lot of them... regressed to the mean, as it turned out.
In the past, you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So you're saying we shouldn't necessarily take too much from this good non-conference schedule for Stanford?
I mean, they played... They took care of business. They did what they were supposed to do. But there weren't a lot of impressive wins, like I said. There was only one top 100 win. Their final non-conference game, or the second to last non-conference game, playing, I believe that was at the Chase Center. They beat San Diego by 3 points.
All right.
And that's a team that UW beat at home by 19 points.
All right.
Despite starting slow, to your point. So I don't think it was that dominant a non-conference schedule. They just won all the games. Anyways, Cal, in nation's bottom 10 in three-point attempt rate, just 27% of their shots coming from beyond the arc, though they're hitting 37% of those rare attempts. Also in the bottom 10 nationally in assist rate, they start a three-guard lineup, none of them bigger than 6'4", that will probably have a difficult time handling Jaden McDaniels. The other thing we should mention, by the way, while we're here, is Nate Roberts got a chance to play in that USC game, and he looked awesome. I don't know that, like, you know, people were ready to just throw Hamir Wright to the bench and play Nate Roberts all the time. I don't know if I'd go that far because he's still going to have a tough time spacing the court in a lot of situations. You know, you would put Nate Roberts in the weak side in the corner and USC would just help off him pretty liberally. But when you're able to get him in the paint, then he is a force to be reckoned with. And, you know, as UW looks to add more depth through conference play, I think he will definitely be a bigger part of the factor in their games. But I'd still think Jamal Bey is their best option right now at small forward. UW women's basketball got a win.
So I guess just before then, percentage chance of victory in each of these games.
Okay, so, I'd say about 45% at Stanford, 40 to 45, somewhere in that range. You know, fairly similar teams, but home court giving the edge to the Cardinal in Palo Alto, and then about 80% at Cal.
Wow, okay.
I mean, Cal did beat the Huskies last year with probably a worse team.
Oh, boy.
Which, by the way, one of the good news here, I didn't put this in the notes, Connor Vanover, you'll recall him as the 7-foot center who gave the Huskies a lot of trouble, or he's like 7'2". Is no longer there.
He
transferred to Arkansas to play for Eric Musselman there. That's good news. Yeah. UW women's basketball was in the Bay Area last weekend, got a 67-64 win Friday at Cal, one of the best of the Jody Wynn era, before losing 77-56 at Stanford, at number 5 Stanford. Amber Melgoza keyed the upset win in Berkeley, scoring 31 points on 13 of 25 shooting, while the Huskies held Cal to 2% accuracy from the field. The UW women now 10-4 in the season and 2-1 in conference play, having already matched their 2018-19 total for conference wins. Took them 2 games to do it after they played 17 last year. Back home for their Pac-12 home opener on Saturday against the rival Cougs, the second time in 4 games, they'll play Wazoo. That game at 12:30 on Saturday. Sadly, I will not be able to make it because I will be coaching your Baby Fantasy Geniuses basketball team, but I hope a good crowd for that.
Oh, hello.
Is it time for the coach's corner?
Yeah, we're going to have that next week.
We sure are.
With you instead of me.
I was thinking about this earlier after the practice, and it occurred to me that, you know how every broadcast, if they have a color analyst who has ever been a coach at any level with any level of success, you always got to refer to him as the coach. So now we're referring to you as the coach.
Dan Bellamy. You're the coach, though.
This week I am the coach. I didn't try to get too involved at practice since none of the kids knew who I was. And only the famous cousin Katie's.
You go by the name Creepy Man over there.
Oh, no. Only the famous cousin Katie's daughter recognized when you asked at the end of practice after you had said earlier who was going to be coaching.
Who's coaching? They're like, why is that man standing there talking to us about shooting more threes?
But I tried to teach.
He's yelling spacing at me.
Only threes and dunks. They're like, we can't dunk.
What is the term that you use for players who take attention away from?
What do you mean, take attention away?
You know, who's like, their spacing matters.
Oh, gravity.
Gravity. You're like, gravity! Gravity!
Okay, I was told via text that an NBA player referenced gravity in a conversation at dinner with someone I know. So,
and we know that no NBA player would reference gravity.
Like the actual, somebody, but this was in an NBA context. So, you know, it's catching on very slowly. It's catching on.
People are catching on to gravity. And let me just say,
one second grader at a time.
Yeah, one second grader at a time. You are teaching them young. I'm out there trying to teach spacing. Look, I stopped practice. And some part of you wants to do like kind of annoying coach thing or whatever. When a kid does something so clearly like dumb or whatever, like just dribbling straight toward out of bounds and getting themselves stopped in a corner. But then at the same time, I'm like, when I play basketball, I do that too sometimes.
Oh, no.
I should know better. But I'm turning around and firing those threes no matter how many people are defending me from the corner.
I like that you jumped in on the drill, and I was wondering how much restraint it took to like not block every shot.
Oh, when I was playing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I just kept forgetting which team I was on.
You really did.
I thought you meant that I jumped in on the drill by pausing the practice and being like freeze. All right, what are we supposed to do in this situation? I feel like that's a pretty, that's like a like advanced level coaching move.
You need a whistle, though. You got to get a whistle.
Yeah, I think I'd be more intimidating with a whistle.
Oh, for sure.
You know what I'm going to have? I'm going to need a whistle and some New Balance shoes.
I think you could go with the Air Carols.
Air Carols and then visible white socks. That's what you had. Anyway, next week we're going to have Coach's Corner from you. You're going to talk about your decision making.
I look forward to it. I mean, the famous cousin Katie is in charge. I'm just her assistant.
Okay, maybe we'll have Katie on to talk about her decision making.
It could be a good time to have
her. Katie will roast those players. I don't think that's safe. No second grader is safe with Katie coaching them.
UW football. We have. Should we also toast to this Sevan Achmed declaring for the NFL draft? And you know what I say? Go get your money, Sevan.
Go get paid, Sevan.
Like, given everything we know about the lifespan of running backs and how difficult it is for them to get paid, there is zero reason for you to play any extra years in college and not get paid than you need to. So I 100% endorse this decision, even though I would have loved, obviously, to have Sevan Achmed back on the Husky roster next season.
Where do you think that Sevan projects as a draft pick? It is really hard to get a sense of it.
Did you see, I saw this, a list of like underclassmen who had declared for the draft at the skill positions, and there was like more running backs, substantially more than quarterbacks, but I think maybe even more than wide receivers.
They're just getting out of there and trying to get their money.
Yeah, everyone has reached the same conclusion, so I don't know.
Do you think in youth football that, like high school football, that players will stop trying to be running backs? Or is, because the allure, like let's say allure-wise, of the position, quarterback is number one, wide receiver is number two, running back is number three.
But I feel like in terms of if like high school football in particular, running back is above wide receiver.
You
like
think that
probably
want...
changey a little bit, like especially in Texas where apparently every high school team runs the spread now. But
do they?
I think so.
Oh wow,
there may have been a Friday Night Lights plot line about it. No, but like they've gotten so good at passing that maybe it makes more sense to
high
play wide receiver
can pass
there.
Now.
But I still think in this, like if you're in the state of Washington, running backs are more dominant players at the high school level than wide receivers are.
It's like, it's a strange financial gamut, right? Where you're like, I can maybe be a running back and get the ball enough in high school to get to college or whatever and be able to like maybe dominate. But then when you get to the point of actually making money on football at the position, your chances of being drafted high are decreasing every single year.
Well, let's be clear that like you have to be equally good as a wide receiver as a running back for it to make a difference. Because fringe
but
wide
also,
receivers are still making as little as fringe running
you
backs.
You still play, the amount of wide receivers who got on the field this year is greater than the amount of running backs who got on the field.
True.
Just even having the opportunity to play. Yeah. There's a lot more wide receivers. And the lifespan of a wide receiver is much longer than the lifespan of a running back.
It sure is.
So, like, if you're an elite athlete who could hypothetically play or play cornerback, right? Like, there are other positions out there.
Or play linebacker if you're Shaq Thompson.
Yeah.
Or Miles Jack.
I'm saying, like, it would be if I were a star high school athlete, and clearly college level running backs are getting it, right? It's not like people are not noticing what's happening.
Yes.
I mean, when we were talking about, like, Chris Carson, for all intents and purposes, has been a pretty good NFL running back. But when we talk about the idea of re-signing him, like, fuck no. Right?
And you were like that before he was seriously injured.
Yeah. I mean, it would be absurd for the Seahawks to spend any significant amount of money on a running back. Just extreme draft capital.
No, just keep bringing Marshawn out of retirement. So the Huskies...
There's always going to be former Seahawks running backs to bring out of retirement.
Two snaps. Those two snaps Robert Turbin got were great. The Husky depth chart at running back, Richard Newton presumably becomes the starter next year, coming off a really strong Las Vegas Bowl for him.
Fired up for Richard Newton as the starter.
It'll be interesting to see whether he can like break off big plays, chunk plays, but he's so good in short yardage situations.
I think Richard Newton can do it all.
I think Sean McGrew's going to have a good senior season. I hope he gets a lot of playing time and stays healthy. And then Kamari Pleasant also at the depth chart. And Cameron Davis got some carries late in the season. So plenty of options there for the Huskies, even without Savon Ahmed. The perhaps bigger news from a UW standpoint has to do with offensive coordinator, where early Monday...
I've got some news on this.
No, it just broke during this podcast?
Pretty close.
Okay. Kellen Moore's staying in Dallas?
Well, finish what you were saying.
Well, early Monday, Ian Rappaport of NFL Network reported that Kellen Moore was the Cowboys offensive coordinator, was, quote, mulling an offer to become UW's offensive coordinator and come back home to the state of Washington or stay in the same role with the Cowboys. Later in the day, Rappaport and Mike Garofalo of NFL Network reported that he's leaning towards staying in Dallas, which was aggressively courting him to return.
As of 10:15 p.m. from DallasCowboys.com, Kellen Moore expected back as offensive coordinator of the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah, I think we see the direction this is heading, and it makes sense.
One of the coordinators won't be new. this is done. Maybe they don't have he shouldn't be under contract though. Maybe he just hasn't said 100% yes, right? Because he was never fired.
He was not fired, no.
And so they had to have a multi-year contract with him.
Presumably.
But it says one of the coordinators won't be new as Kellen Moore is expected to return to the staff for a second year. So, the dream of Kellen Moore has died in Seattle.
Which was a nightmare to some Husky fans. He was clearly plan A for the Huskies. It is unclear who plan B is.
This is bad. Okay, let me ask you a question.
I mean, it's not great, but I also, like, there was one of the highly touted offensive coordinators got snapped up. I
think all of them.
All of them?
Yeah.
I mean... Todd Monken is still out there.
Is he really? I thought there was rumors about where Todd Monken was going.
I mean, there might be rumors.
I thought that one looked pretty much done.
There were rumors about Kellen Moore to UW. Those turned out not to be true. Sometimes rumors are inaccurate. That's why they're rumors. I'm not seeing any of these rumors.
Okay. I was under the impression that Todd Monken was returning to Oklahoma State.
Seems like a possibility.
How many good offensive coordinators do you think there are at all levels in the country?
I mean, how are we defining good?
That's the other thing is like good is so defined by the talent around you and the situation and injuries, et cetera. But like,
how many offensive coordinators who know the value of play action and like to pass a lot on early downs?
This is what I'm saying to you. Okay. Let's say apples to apples, all things being equal, the like continuation of the program aspects be damned. Starting the program anew, who would you choose as your head coach? Kellen Moore or Jimmy Lake?
Jimmy Lake. Proven recruiting ability. We've never seen Kellen Moore recruit.
But it's close, right?
I had to think about it for a second. I don't know if I would say it's close.
You don't think so?
I mean, there's obviously value to having an offensive-minded head coach, I think, but...
Kellen Moore will be a head coach somewhere, at some level, within the next 5 years.
One would think.
So, like, and the chances of that being in
the NFL... Which,
by the
way, is maybe the argument against hiring Kellen Moore is...
Is that he could be destined to have an NFL head coaching job.
Yeah. Or a college head coaching job.
It's just... People who were complaining about this, I wish that it was still on the table so I could get a little bit more passionate about this. People, UW fans who felt like Kellen Moore wasn't a good choice for offensive coordinator are out of their fucking minds.
It seems likely that if you can put together a top five NFL offense, you can probably be an effective offensive coordinator at the college level, especially because his first year as an offensive coordinator, we have to presume there's a learning curve and he's going to get better. So... I mean, part of the thing is, like, you ask, like, you know, who's out there. Like, look, the Huskies might hire some offensive coordinator from the Big Sky Conference that you and I have literally never heard of, but is a great choice. I mean, I'm not really out there evaluating offensive coordinators in college football that frequently, and I don't think most people are.
What do we think about Bo Baldwin?
Bo Baldwin became the head coach at Cal Poly, left Cal for the offensive coordinator job for that.
Dallas's offense, DVOA-wise, last year ranked 24th, and this season was the second best offense in the NFL.
I mean, they did have a full season of Amari Cooper for what that's worth. But
they had how many games last year of Amari Cooper?
The evidence in favor of Kellen Moore as a good offensive coordinator is pretty strong.
He ran the second best offense in the NFL this season. And it's not like the talent was overwhelming with the Cowboys. And it clearly was not that different than it was last year where they ranked 24th. Like, Kellen Moore would have been the biggest upgrade at offensive coordinator of any coach for any team this entire offseason. Anywhere. Second only to Baltimore. Like,
I would have felt really good about it.
It would have been a game changer. I
wouldn't go that far.
I mean, it'll probably be fine, but like, who knows?
They definitely did put a lot of eggs in this basket, so it's not great if it doesn't happen.
I mean, the reality is I don't think they were wrong to do that because of what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, because the magnitude, if they had hired Kellen Moore, the upgrade between Bush Hamden and Kellen Moore.
And clearly he was indicating interest to them behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if he doesn't get this opportunity to return in Dallas, if Dallas hires somebody else who has their own offensive coordinator or whatever, then Kellen Moore's probably the offensive coordinator of the Washington Huskies.
Yeah.
So I think you, for somebody who is that important, you have to just take your time and take the risk.
Agreed.
And so, like, sure, they lost out on other choices, but like, they took a big swing and they missed. And hopefully that isn't the name of the game for the Jimmy Lake era at UW.
But I just don't know that whoever they hire is going to be that appreciably different than who they would have hired 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. It's fine. It just sucks that they didn't get Kellen Moore.
Let's talk about some NFL offenses that were not quite as good as the Cowboys in terms of DVOA this season. As we move out of the Seahawks section in preview, this Sunday's divisional round matchup at Green Bay. Any additional thoughts on the Philadelphia game? Lingering after we did the post-game podcast on Sunday?
I don't know if I'm shocked, but the people of Philadelphia really don't like Jadeveon Clowney.
They're not... First off, they're not wrong. I mean, to be upset that their quarterback was hurt, I don't think that means you need to take it out on the individual and talk about how dirty the play is. For the number of times we hear about how, you know, on a play where a quarterback isn't injured, that what was the defender supposed to do? Was he supposed to defy the rules of physics? Like, to not apply that in that situation.
Those people didn't pop out. None of those people, like, came out of the woodwork, which, granted, this wasn't exactly that play, but like, every single one of those, like, I'm sure there are a couple, but like, the defensive people on broadcast who are just like, oh, I don't know what could happen or whatever, you know, like,
I guess you're not supposed to tackle him anymore. Like, obviously that wasn't the case here, but you know, that person is,
those people didn't really come favorite out of the woodworks anymore. I'm sure that there are probably many Eagles fans who have the same perspective.
I hope they feel the same way when quarterbacks on other teams are injured and that it's not strictly about the team for which they root. We don't feel like we've got a strong grasp yet on the injury situation for the Seahawks heading into this game. Pete Carroll, pretty vague on Monday, said that Mike Iupati is still dealing with the stinger that caused him to miss Sunday's game. That was also the injury that Ezekiel Ansah left that game with, so unclear whether he'll be back this week. Same with Dwayne Brown trying to come back quickly from that knee surgery. The one thing we did learn is that wide receiver Jerron Brown should be good to go after missing Sunday's game for personal reasons.
Free John Ursua. Always.
I don't know if he's going to be active this week, if Malik Turner and Jerron Brown are both back. We didn't get an update on Turner, but you would think he'll be able to clear concussion protocol The Packers, looking pretty healthy after getting the bye week, center Corey Linsley left the regular season finale after his back locked up, but is back practicing this week.
Man, I would have left that game too.
So is right tackle Brian Bulaga, who was in concussion protocol, and hybrid linebacker safety Raven Green was designated to return off IR. Sounds like he could be a big factor again, having not played since week two for the Packers.
Great.
So let's talk about the Packers, who come into this game. I mean, we got to start with Rodgers, right? We got to start with, like, it's difficult to understand exactly why his stats are as bad as they are. The Packers were 11th in pass DVOA this year. Individually, he was 15th in expected points added per play, is tracked by our third Belton brother, Ben Baldwin, 28th in next-gen stats completion plus-minus, comparing what you'd expect his completion percentage to be based on the location of his passes and how open his receivers were compared to what he actually did this season. You seem shocked by this information.
No, I'm reading the stat that you're going to say next, and I think you've got something wrong here, sir.
That he's still capable of dominant performances, including 13.8 yards per attempt against Oakland.
Didn't they get killed by Oakland in that game?
No.
Yeah, well, they lost to Oakland.
Did they?
Yeah. I'm telling you, something does not add up there.
I am unclear about that. He definitely dominated Oakland because I was looking at whether it was...
They lost the game.
I guess they did. No, they won 42-24.
What was the game that I was thinking?
He had five touchdowns and no interceptions. Obviously, he had no interceptions. The Packers fans love that touchdown to interception ratio when they're talking about Aaron Rodgers, who led the NFL for the second consecutive season in the lowest interception ratio.
Who was the team who played terrible against Oakland? I thought that was a game that the Packers lost. I've been citing this for weeks.
I don't know. Rodgers had thrown six interceptions in the last two seasons, which Jameis Winston calls a half. In addition to that performance against Oakland, I say 9.2 yards per attempt against Kansas City. And then if we go back to last season against the Seahawks, he had 11.1 yards per attempt at CenturyLink Field on a Thursday night in a game the Packers lost. And you'll recall was the post-game pod where we read Bill Barnwell's mentions and Packers fans just melting down at the idea that Aaron Rodgers was not to blame for this loss in a game where he did take five sacks.
Okay, but now do the game where he completed 23 passes and had 81 yards.
Which one was that?
Against the Niners in week 12.
Oh, boy. I mean, here's the thing. Is like
2.2 yards per attempt. Like, that is... He's getting up there in worst of all time territory.
Like, we probably mentioned this on Sunday in the post-game pod, but it just feels like this game was the inevitable result of Ben Baldwin's trolling Aaron Rodgers and Packers fans all season on Twitter. Like, the only potential outcome was playing the Packers in the playoffs with so much at stake, where Aaron Rodgers is still terrifying as a Seahawks fan.
Well, and I think the terrifying aspect of it is what his entire reputation is based off of at this point. Like, it takes a long time for a quarterback who was good to be perceived as not good anymore.
I mean, not just quarterback, but yes.
And the way that that has to happen is not even through the way that Aaron Rodgers is not that good of a quarterback anymore. It has to be through having a weak arm, right? Like, Aaron Rodgers could miss deep passes and people won't care. I think the only way that people will be like, you're not good anymore, is by throwing, like, just not having the arm strength to make routine throws anymore.
Well, I think the other way would be by the Packers not being good. And the fact that they went 13-3 certainly makes it more difficult for anyone to see that, you know, there might be an issue here.
But it is that terror aspect. And that's how Aaron Rodgers gets ranked number one by Mike Sando's quarterback tiers, despite not really being like an elite level quarterback for the past four seasons now.
Which, to be clear, reflect the opinion of the player evaluators, the front office executives that Mike Sando talked to before the season.
And people who apparently don't watch the games.
I mean, if you watch the film, like, the one thing that becomes really evident watching, you know, the cut-ups that Ben V in particular does to try to troll Aaron Rodgers is, like, he's still got the arm strength. He's still got the cannon, but his footwork is so awful. Like, he's never on balance when he throws. He's like, you know, trying to basically, he's like the, you know, player with terrible fundamentals who's overcoming them through sheer talent, which is a weird thing for Aaron Rodgers, like the guy who went from junior college to Super Bowl MVP. But, you know, I think at one point he definitely was able to overcome that with his arm and it didn't matter, but now it has caught up to him, particularly like watching that Detroit game where he was missing throws all over the field against one of the NFL's worst defenses.
You think his footwork was always that bad?
It's probably slipped a little bit.
What do you consider a good yards per attempt?
8, probably.
How many times do you think the Packers were over 8 yards per attempt this season?
3?
2 times.
The 2 games I mentioned?
No, that Kansas City game, they're only at 7.8 yards per attempt.
Oh, is that net yards per attempt including sacks?
I don't know, just whatever Pro Football Reference's yards per attempt is.
I don't know. I mean, I looked at that game earlier using yards per attempt, so that's...
They passed for 256 yards in the game, and he had 33 attempts.
Well, he had 305 yards, so that does seem to be taking sacks into account.
Oh, okay, so that's why this is bad. Wow, and he got sacked...
Yeah, he got sacked 5 times for 49 yards in that game, high. So...
Okay, I mean, so he might have been over 8 a couple more times.
Once you go net yards per attempt, he was 4 times over 8 yards per attempt. Also, their wins over Denver and Carolina at home. And in almost exactly 7 yards per attempt in their loss at home to Philadelphia in a game where they scored 27 points, but the defense let them down in that one.
I do think it's the accuracy. I think it's throwing passes away. And still having a tendency to... I don't want to call it checking down because I don't feel like that's exactly what Rodgers does. But, like, you know, some of these yards per attempt are just not very good.
Yeah, no, I think that is what he does. I mean, if you look at his targets, you know, a lot of his top target was Devontae Adams. His number 2 target was Aaron Jones. His number 3 target was Jimmy Graham. And none of those guys had particularly high yards per target overall. Adams caught 65% of his passes, but averaged fewer yards per attempt than Marquez Valdes-Scantling, who only caught 46% of the passes thrown his way, but had more big plays. Their leaders in yards per target are young receivers. Jake Kumerow has kind of come on over the course of the season, and Alan Lazard. So, you know, it's an interesting breakdown of where he's going and where he's having most success. So the driver of the success of this Green Bay offense, you would really have to say, was their rushing game. They were 4th in rush DVOA. Their offensive line has been excellent. It was number 1 in pass block. Win rate also helped, you know, control the ground game. Aaron Jones was 7th in rushing DVOA individually. And Jamal Williams not as good at 21st. It was also interesting that though Williams rated well and Jones surprisingly mediocre as a receiver this season, the Packers have been wildly more successful with Jones on the field than Williams on the field at running back, as noted by Bill Barnwell in his playoff preview and also by Ben Baldwin. This season, they averaged 0.15 expected points added per play with Jones at running back and minus 0.07 expected points added per play with Jamal Williams at running back. Rodgers' QBR was 67.7 with Jones and 28.7 with Williams. So one of the interesting things...
So running backs matter is what you're saying?
I mean, it's a small sample size.
Entrapment. Well, you have to admit it.
Well, there's probably a lot of randomness in those stats, but one thing you would expect to see in this game is a lot of Aaron Jones. Like, the Packers just riding him now that it's the playoffs.
Ah! Or if there's one coach who's prepared to defend a running back like Aaron Jones, it's Pete Carroll. If there's one coach
out of the backfield or just like committing way too many resources to the
committing
run?
Way too many resources to the run.
Like, love to commit way too many resources to the run and get torn up by Josh McCown. Although they weren't actually that good against the run on Sunday either. It was mostly just taking away deep plays.
When the Seahawks look at the Packers, I don't know. It really is interesting to just try to consider how Pete Carroll's brain views these things. because he probably doesn't grasp how important somebody like Aaron Jones is to the Packers. They're probably more scared of Aaron Rodgers because the perspective is probably leans more toward the quarterback tier type players. But if they can take Aaron Jones in the running game out of this game and put it squarely in Aaron Rodgers' hands, you're looking at it and you're like, is he going to have this one game against the Raiders where he averaged 13 yards per attempt?
Yeah.
Or potentially, you know, even this game that he had against the Seahawks last year, but could it be a 6-7 type game, which he had many of this season, right? And the real key to this game is forcing Aaron Rodgers to throw the ball.
I don't know if I go that far. I mean, I think the key to the game is which Aaron Rodgers we see. I think that's 100% a key to the game.
But why are there two Aaron Rodgers?
I mean, part of it's whether he's getting pressured. There's not like a strong correlation between his success and the opponent's pass rush win rate, but there is a correlation between those two.
Name a bad quarterback.
Name a bad quarterback.
Who started this year?
David Blau?
Yeah, let's check out David Blau.
Did I go too far there?
That might have been too far.
You remember when we were counting on David Blau to help the
Seahawks? Oh, Blau! Maybe David Blau.
Get a bye in the first
round. Galaxy brain. Did help us.
I don't know if I'd go that far.
By losing that game, he set up Seahawks versus Packers.
We've got a lot of stats to get to before we.
Okay,
get
David Blau didn't really have any good games. But I'm saying that his best yards per attempt was 7.37. No. But there are quarterbacks. Josh Allen, right? Like, can we accept that Josh Allen is probably a bad passer?
Yeah, he's definitely not a good passer. I mean, I'm not sure he's the worst passer.
Josh Allen against Dallas on Thanksgiving, 9.63 yards per attempt. Had four games over eight, in fact, right? Two of them were exactly at eight.
Danny Dimes had two games over eight this season. His debut at Tampa.
Did he have like one huge game, though?
His debut at Tampa, 9.3 yards per attempt.
Wow, so man, that game that Rodgers had was like pretty incredible.
Oh, I mean, if you look at Ben B's like quarterback game by game and the percentile rankings, he had, I think Rodgers had two or three games that were around the 90th percentile for all quarterbacks. And that one was like way above those other two games. It was like beyond the 100th percentile, even though that's not possible mathematically.
So what I'm saying to you,
so many standard deviations,
is when you're judging Josh Allen, you're not saying, well, he's...
You're not just judging him by his best games.
Yeah, like that's insane to be like Aaron Rodgers had one excellent game this season.
But before you play him in the playoffs, you should definitely judge him by his best games.
I'm saying have a healthy amount of fear because that's how we should approach these things. But looking... By approaching it from that perspective, you're looking at it from the same perspective that leads Aaron Rodgers to being perceived as the best quarterback in the NFL because he had one really good game.
I mean, also because he had many very good seasons. It's just been a while since he had those seasons, as it turned out.
I mean, like, it's been four seasons since he was, like, an elite-level quarterback. At some point, that's just what it is. Like, how much sample size do you need for this?
Well, the only sample size that he needs is one game, so that's not a very big sample size, as it turns out.
I hear what you're saying, and I agree.
But especially if the Seahawks can't pressure him, which is a realistic possibility, because a lot of the season looked that way. I mean, one of the big things is, you know, is Jadeveon Clowney able to just wreck shit, basically.
Oh, God,
and against
please.
This Green Bay offensive line, he may not be able to wreck shit.
Oh, wreck shit, Jadeveon.
Lifelong wrecking shit fan.
Let me just tell you how many games Jameis had over 8 yards per attempt.
I bet it was a lot.
It was a lot.
How many games did he have? How many games did he had four interceptions? So Rodgers had four interceptions this season. Jameis had at least one game with four interceptions, right?
He had a couple.
Yeah.
And the Seahawks was actually like right in the middle of the Jameis yards per attempt.
I think that avoiding interceptions is an overrated skill, but it is a useful skill nonetheless. Especially against a defense like the Seahawks that tends to thrive on takeaways. And if it doesn't, you're getting a lot of really long Josh McCown drives.
Oh, God. I don't want to, like... I don't want to spit on Aaron Rodgers' grave. especially as we're about to play them in the playoffs. I have a very healthy amount of fear. The Seahawks will probably lose this game, and they'll probably lose this game because of Aaron Rodgers. But that doesn't mean that Aaron Rodgers is a good quarterback because of it.
There might be some other reasons they might lose this game.
All right, what are those reasons?
Let's talk about the Packers defense, which started off and ended the season elite against the pass, but allowed 8.8 yards per attempt in these seven games kind of in between that, but finished 10th in pass defense DVOA, according to Football Outsiders.
And by end of the season elite, you mean played David Blau in the last game, or?
Kirk Cousins, they did a pretty good job against him and the Vikings in Week 16 in clinching the NFC North.
I'm saying that was a bad game because Dalvin Cook didn't play, because running backs matter, according to you!
Alexander Mattison looked just fine against the Saints on Sunday. Good, sir.
Mike Booth did not look good in that game.
The pass rush was key to the difference. The Packers were 8-1 this season with at least 3 sacks, 5-2 when they had 2 or fewer. They were 9th in pass rush win rate and 7th in sack rate, having signed a pair of Smiths in free agency this offseason. Zadarius Smith had 13.5 sacks. Preston Smith had 12 sacks. Not a ton of pass rushing depth behind them. Just one other player, nose tackle Kenny Clark, had more than 3 sacks this season. Of course, the Seahawks were led in sacks with 4.
But oh, God.
Rasheem Green with 4. That's F-O-U-R, 4. They were 23rd, though, in rush defense. And, you know, definitely had some games where they were torn up on the ground, give up at least 5 yards per carry in 7 games. The one game where they were really elite was the Vikings struggled to run the ball in the Monday Night Football loss, as we mentioned. But then the Lions kind of ran over them a little bit in the season finale and staying in that game with David Blau at quarterback. And I think one of the things we're going to see is a different game plan from the Seahawks, who came out looking to throw last Sunday in Philadelphia and maybe hoping to reestablish the ground game with more Marshawn Lynch this week.
Oh, yeah. Because once you get away from the run, there's no going back to the run.
Man's atavistic need to run into a stacked box. Looking individually at the Green Bay pass defense, our old friend Kevin King, the UW product, had 5 interceptions this season, but gave up 10.2 yards per target, the most among defenders targeted at least 80 times this season. Slightly more.
Take that, Jimmy Lake.
Xavier Rhodes at 9.7 yards per target this season, according to Pro Football Reference's advanced tracking.
Wow, Dalvin Cook's game against the Saints, wow, he ran a lot of times. It was 28 for 94.
It was a very conservative game plan.
Alexander Mattison only had 5 carries.
But they were good carries.
5 for 20, and he had 16 on 1.
Okay, it was a good carry.
Scale-wise, it was a Marshawn-like game. He could have been on the Seahawks on Sunday with that type of performance.
Wow, he would have been the leading rusher on the Seahawks by a wide margin if he would have had 5 carries for 20 yards.
He definitely had 4 other carries for 4 yards.
Their opposite cornerback, Jaire Alexander, faced the third most targets in the NFL this season, 110, but gave up a solid 7.4 yards per attempt. So probably want to throw it in King's direction, but be a little careful when you do so.
The Packers defy logic.
By being 13-3?
Yeah. I mean, what if I were to tell you
that they had a worse DVOA than the Seahawks?
And somehow the Houston Texans are still alive. But at number 23 in DVOA, yep, that they were the second worst team by a fairly significant margin.
I don't know if I would go that far.
There's teams in between them.
Sure.
Philadelphia really dropped in DVOA after that loss to the Seahawks.
Turns out playing Josh McCown at quarterback isn't great for your DVOA.
But
actually, it was in that game. It turns out Carson Wentz at quarterback was not great for your DVOA, but sorry, Philly fans. One of those teams, by the way, the Dallas Cowboys and offensive coordinator Kellen Moore.
Terrible. Hate him. The Seahawks have a better offense statistically than Green Bay. Have a relatively similar defense.
Yeah.
And granted, it's not like the Seahawks didn't win a lot of games also. But it felt like when the Seahawks were winning those games,
and relatively similar special teams.
It was miraculous for the Seahawks to win these games, right?
Yeah, I mean, you look at their point differential. They barely outscored opponents on the season. Green Bay had a plus 62 differential. And part of that is schedule was dramatically different.
Okay. I mean, they played a much easier schedule. So is that what you're telling me? Like, what was their strength of schedule for the season? Is that how Green Bay, by being an average team and playing an easy schedule, is that how they get to 13-3?
That was a factor in it. I mean, also, you know, the Seahawks were rated much better by DVOA because of the fact that they lost so many expected points based on fumbles, which are considered, you know, essentially random by DVOA. But the Seahawks,
they lost a lot of fumbles.
I mean, Green Bay basically played an average schedule, almost exactly league average. It was more that the Seahawks schedule was second hardest by DVOA.
How did the Packers go 13-3? What happened?
They concentrated their bad performances in a couple of games, I guess.
And they got to play Matt Moore instead of Pat Mahomes.
Yeah, that was helpful.
I mean, just like going through these games, they beat the Bears. I'm just go through the whole fucking thing, right? They play the Bears and win 10-3 to kick off the season. Thrilling performance there. Rodgers is back with those 10 points. I remember the take was like, well, the defense is going to carry them all season.
That was where people were talking a lot about the pass rush and the Smiths.
What are the good wins on this schedule?
The Smiths reinvented themselves as bookend pass rushers. A real change of direction for them.
What are the good wins? They beat the Vikings, they beat the Vikings by 5 at home, and then they beat them on that Monday Night Football game where
They beat them by 13.
Dalvin Cook didn't play. Adam Thielen was not back. Alexander Mattison didn't play. If you want to talk about Alexander Mattison being just as good, Mike Boone started.
I mean, which running back do you think the Seahawks are on right now? You're aware that they're on their fourth and fifth running backs right now, right?
But Mike Boone would be a godsend to them.
He would be a boon.
They beat the Broncos by 11, who were terrible at the beginning of the season. They lost to Philadelphia 34-27. They went into Dallas and won, which
that was a very impressive victory.
But was it? Like, yeah. A lot of teams beat Dallas.
But Dallas is still a good team. We agree.
Okay, they
beat
Detroit by a point on Monday Night Football thanks to 2 terrible penalties. They had that great game against the Raiders. They beat the Matt Moore Chiefs. They played terrible at the LA Chargers. They beat the Kyle Allen Panthers by 8 points.
How much do you think the Seahawks beat the Kyle Allen Panthers by?
I'm just saying, okay, I'm saying where are the good wins? The Seahawks have a lot of good wins on the schedule.
Yeah.
Or at least some. They went into San Francisco and got destroyed by San Francisco. They comfortably beat the Giants. They beat Washington by 5. They beat the Bears again by 8. Then they had that Monday Night Football game against the Vikings, and then they almost lost to the Lions. This is a garbage schedule. This is not a middle-of-the-pack schedule. Like, how much credit are you giving to getting destroyed by the 49ers to this schedule? They basically played the Eagles' end-of-year schedule that we mocked a week ago the entire season.
I don't
like
know
the Patriots would have been lucky to have played the schedule. It's not that they didn't play any horrible teams. I guess that's what I'll give them, aside from maybe the Lions. Like, they didn't play any of the absolute worst teams in the league necessarily, whereas the Patriots schedule was most of those teams. But they didn't also play, aside from as far as like what you would consider the top in DVOA. Did they play Baltimore? No. Did they play New Orleans? No. They played Kansas City with Mahomes, or without Mahomes. They didn't play Tennessee. They got destroyed by San Francisco. They didn't play the Patriots. Like, I just...
2 of 6.
I don't know.
You play 13 teams out of 32. It's not really that out of the ordinary. I think, the Seahawks had a scarred schedule, because how many of those teams did they play that you just mentioned? They played San Francisco twice. They played New Orleans
and Baltimore, number 1 and number 2. What are you talking about?
I'm saying they played an exceptionally hard schedule. That's, okay. Again, the takeaway.
But this Packers team is smoke and mirrors.
Oh, so you're picking the Seahawks then?
Let's fucking do it.
Okay, I want to talk about you do your chances of victory. Go for it.
Are we there? Are we there yet?
You're there.
I'm just saying, like, all season you would look at the Packers' record and you're like, how is that their record? They never seem like a good team. Like, how do the 49ers need to beat the Seahawks?
Well, they're not going
to
seem like a good team into the NFC Championship game.
And then they're going to get killed. Like... This at no point during the season were the Packers like, should they have been in the conversation for getting a bye, right?
It's not a conversation.
The Cowboys gave their playoff spot to this, right? They sacrificed their playoff spot to have the Packers be 13-3 and get the second seed. Seeding should be determined by DVOA.
There's not a selection committee for the playoffs. They just do it based on wins. So what's your chance of victory?
It became a lot higher after looking at that schedule for the Packers. Is Russell Wilson the best quarterback that Green Bay has played all season?
It's probably either him or Dak Prescott.
I just think the Seahawks are a better team.
Kirk Cousins had a strong season.
I think the Seahawks are a better... Look, I'm going to pull an Aaron Rodgers and say he's done it for a little bit longer than 1 year. But we're talking about pedigree here. Look, he was good 5 years ago. He was good all the way back to when Aaron Rodgers was good.
Back then, Kirk Cousins was throwing 4 interceptions for you.
Well, my children were being born.
And not your youngest child, your middle child.
I'll never forgive him for that. I don't think Russell Wilson has played. Granted, Green Bay has been hard for the Seahawks. He's played twice in Green Bay or once? Just once. That Sunday night game.
No. Sunday night? There was a Sunday afternoon game. And
there was a Sunday
night
game.
The season opener at Green Bay.
They played a season opener at Green Bay? Oh, God. That game where they stole the touchdown from...
Nas Jones. Yes.
Just, I'll never forgive them for that. That was bad Seahawks, though.
Who are you not forgiving for that?
I don't know. Whomever. A lot of people. That was terrible. But the team changed after they got back to running the ball.
Oh, that's very true.
Was that the season opener? And then they went at Denver the next week?
No, you're thinking that was the next season. They were at Denver and then at Chicago were the first two games. And then shoddy. This was the last Daryl Bevel season.
Oh, that was a cursed season. There's reasons for everything.
Are there?
The Seahawks are a better team than the Green Bay Packers are. They have a better quarterback. They have better players at the most important positions. They have better wide receivers. I think their defense is about the same. And if the defense is healthy, like, look, this is the 19th ranked defense by DVOA, but if Quandre Diggs is back there, if Jadeveon Clowney is back there, it's a different team. KJ Wright is...
That team only gave up, like, several long drives to Josh McCown.
I'm telling you, I've seen the light when it comes to football. And I was thinking back to that moment where they were talking about how Josh McCown convinced Carson Wentz that checkdowns are good. And I was like, you just ended Carson Wentz's career, dog. Like, you're convincing that Carson Wentz that checkdowns are good meant that you convinced him that bad football is good. That's like being like, hey, I ran the numbers. When you run more, you win the game.
A lot of people did run those numbers.
Right?
We're almost certainly going to see that graphic at some point this weekend.
It's just like, and it's going to be animated. It really is like Josh McCown was like, hey, buddy, you like that completion percentage? That's all people care about. Don't worry about yards per attempt.
You were pretty terrified of Josh McCown on Sunday.
Oh, I have a healthy amount of terror of everybody. I will be terrified of Rodgers. Rodgers will complete passes.
Do you know who Aaron Rodgers' backup is?
Will he? Oh, man. Tim Boyle?
That sounds close.
Ben B tweeted and he was like, this matchup features the two quarterbacks who have the highest...
yards per attempt in the playoffs.
Yards per attempt. And I wanted it so desperately to be like Russell Wilson and then whoever the Packers backup was.
Sadly, it's not Brett Hundley. No.
He only has the highest yards per attempt against the Seahawks.
Good question here. Tim Boyle, backup Packers quarterback or Colorado men's basketball coach?
It's close. Is it Boyle or Doyle?
It's Boyle.
Well, if Jadeveon Clowney has anything Boyle to say about it, we'll find out on Sunday. Convince me that the Packers are better than the Seahawks. What is the situation? Home field doesn't matter anymore. Green Bay is supposed to scare us. Like, what? You're going to tell me the weather, aren't you? God damn it.
Well, you got to give a chance of victory first.
I was going to start out at like 47, and I've swung all the way up to like 58%.
Oh, no. Let's talk about the Seahawks in freezing conditions in the Russell Wilson era, because let's bring up the forecast as well, because it's not probably not snow at this point. It's still, you know, could change. We're several days out, but It's looking very cold. The current projection, according to Weather on the Ground, is a high of 25 degrees on Sunday.
Oh, God.
Snow overnight Saturday night.
And they decided to play this game at like 2 a.m. also.
4 inches of snow on Saturday night. And then possibly some snow late. Possibly by the end of this game, we could see some snow.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
It would be, but maybe not beautiful for Russell Wilson, who, as much as he does not like to be touched by rain, also doesn't love to be touched by freezing cold. The Seahawks have played 3 games, according to Pro Football Reference, that have started at 32 degrees for freezing or lower in Russell Wilson's career. A 24-20 loss at Kansas City in 2014. Their 10-9 win at Minnesota in the 2015 playoffs.
That temperature was different.
The temperature was like zero. And a 38-10 loss in Green Bay in 2016.
Wow. And I think that ended the streak of one-loss games.
It was one of the worst games of the Pete Carroll era by far.
That was the worst team that the Seahawks have fielded.
2016? That team won the division.
Oh.
That's the team that lost in Atlanta in the playoffs.
Crap.
In those games, Russell Wilson has combined for 57% completions, 5.8 yards per attempt, and 6 interceptions in 97 pass attempts. 5 of those coming in that Green Bay game, which is, of course, more than Aaron Rodgers has thrown this entire season. Also, nearly as many as Russell Wilson has thrown this entire season, if I recall correctly. So it's not a large sample size. It's certainly not definitive, but it's a reason you would not like to be going to Green Bay in January.
Why couldn't we get
a traditional house of horrors for the Seahawks? Not just in the playoffs. Any time they go to Green Bay, since
what is the last time the Seahawks won?
1999, Mike Holmgren's first season is
it? There we go. Let's channel that Holmgren energy. We need some big Holmgren energy.
Big Holmgren energy.
And we want the ball, and we're gonna score. On Sunday night.
No, we don't need that.
Look, when Russell Wilson visualizes it, it happens.
5 interceptions this season for Russell Wilson, as many as in that game.
You do know that he went to college in the state of Wisconsin.
I do.
For precisely one season.
You do know they don't play games in Wisconsin after the month of November.
He was born into this.
They don't play a bowl there.
Aaron Rodgers is a California quarterback. Russell Wilson was born into this.
Okay.
He is used to this. He is comfortable there. If Green Bay wins this game and it's because of the weather, it's not going to be because of anything that the quarterback did. It'll be because of Aaron Jones and the Seahawks not being able to stop Aaron Jones. From watching the Packers and actually having Aaron Jones on my fantasy team, I feel like the way that they get him the ball is not the same way that the Seahawks tend to be fooled by rushing attacks. They don't do Kyle Shanahan things.
No, they don't do that.
There's not like a heavy dose of misdirection, right? And I think that is really...
But they have been known to run a running back screen once in a while.
Oh, God.
Which the Seahawks actually handled pretty well against Philadelphia, but that's because they didn't have to worry about any deep passes whatsoever.
This is going to be a huge game for Shaquille Griffin and Trey Flowers. Like, what happened with Trey Flowers last Sunday cannot happen again. The coverage has to be better.
So, the other thing we haven't mentioned, like I mentioned it, but the pass rushing of the Smiths against this offensive line that is probably still going to be somewhat shorthanded. Now, and also
are
Kenny
they
Clark,
better than Fletcher Cox?
They're different.
Okay. Who scares you more? Fletcher Cox is terrifying, right? Am I wrong about this?
Yeah, but nose tackles aren't necessarily like big sack guys. It's not like Fletcher Cox had a lot of sacks this season. That's more of a defensive end outside linebacker thing. And that's why their outside linebackers combined for 25 and a half of them. I don't know if you're aware of it, but the Seahawks sometimes have some trouble giving up sacks.
Oh, God.
I mean, whether Russ can get away from those guys, I think there's 2 keys to the game. Number 1 is which Rodgers we get, and number 2 is can Russ run his way out of pressure.
Do you think they spy Russell Wilson after last week?
I don't know that they have the right player to spy him. I mean, maybe it's the guy they have coming back off IR, Raven Green, who if he played against the Ravens in the Super Bowl, what a match.
Oh, man, that would be so Raven.
So Raven. Those, to me, are the two factors in this game that will determine it, but I think the Seahawks are pretty healthy underdogs in this one because it's not a good matchup. And even though home field doesn't overall matter, the weather may still matter. I would say they have a 40% chance of victory.
What is the difference between the Packers this year and last year? The Packers team that the Seahawks beat last year.
Well, they have a pass rush, number one. They didn't have either of those two guys on the roster last year. They just had Clay Matthews hitting players illegally after the whistle. Nothing? Nothing?
I'm just trying to understand how much fear to have.
I mean, the other difference is, again, that game was at home. This is in 25-degree weather.
Do you think the time of day helps the Seahawks at all?
Yes. Like we've talked about it, the evidence suggests that West Coast teams do better going east in primetime games. And while this isn't quite technically a primetime game, the 3:40 Pacific start,
you know what time it
makes
starts.
It close enough.
They start the game in the fourth quarter. So the whole game will be played in the fourth quarter for the Seahawks.
I don't know if that's how it works. Now, does this become a Seahawks primetime game where just weird shit happens?
Oh, weird shit's going to happen.
That's another good question.
Russell Wilson's going to be peaking from the first second. Oh, I'm excited for this game. I just hope that they don't get down big and then have to fight back.
Like, so like every other divisional round game they've played on the road?
Have they played the division round? Are those, that's it, the Falcons and the Panthers are the only division round games that they played on the road?
They have never played a non-NFC South team in the divisional round.
And both of those games, they got, I mean, that was 10 a.m. on Sunday, that game at Carolina. Like, there was, it was over before the game started.
It was not an ideal
start. Both of those were 10 a.m. starts, right?
No, the Falcons games were
that was
in the
one.
Afternoon. Or no, the first Falcons game was at 10 a.m. The second Falcons game was a Saturday afternoon.
Oh, the second Falcons game.
Everyone always forgets the second Falcons game.
Oh, I like to remember the first one.
And they played the Saints at home. I forget who they played in the divisional round in 2014. It was the Panthers.
That was the Cam picking off Cam game?
Yes.
Well, they really like to... So, they've played the entire NFC South?
No, they haven't played Tampa Bay, sadly. Tampa Bay has not been in the divisional round. Oh,
that's what you're saying.
They've
only in the second round played the NFC South.
Correct.
Russell, wow.
Yeah.
Well, look at this. I guess we'll find out what it's like against the NFC North.
This is much more like the pre-Russell Wilson era where the Seahawks always seemed to go to the NFC North champion in the second round. It was super cold.
And they would get killed.
Yes.
The game would be over after like...
2010 was the Bears.
There was a Packers game in there.
I think that was 2006 because I think that was after the Tony Romo... muffed hold on the extra point. Mm-hmm.
And Ryan Grant, I remember running over them in that game. And this game, the Packers also have Ryan Grant.
Wow, really makes you think.
As their fifth wide receiver or whatever. He's behind Jake Kumerow on the depth chart. I'm looking forward to just... It's going to be cold. We're going to have the potential of snow in Seattle. It's going to be Sunday evening. Right? It's a weird time to even watch a game. Like, I'm fired up for this one.
I wish I was as fired up as you are.
We're living on borrowed time here.
That's also true. Like, anything's gravy at this point.
I mean, we've been lucky enough to have been able to pay attention to Seahawks games very deep into the season, well into January.
We could be starting our search for Seattle's best teriyaki right now.
Yeah. And we're not, and let's not do it for another week. And let's bring the NFC Championship game back to Seattle.
Or to San Francisco.
Does anything change if the Vikings beat the 49ers the day before?
Oh, it'll make me much more nervous about this game because it'll be like we were so excited about the Vikings winning and the potential for a home NFC Championship game that obviously the Seahawks will then blow it.
God, I just wouldn't even really think it would be that fun to watch a Vikings-Packers NFC Championship game. Oh. That would be horrible. We saw that on Monday Night Football, and it was not even a fun regular season game.
Accurate.
You know what was a fun regular season game?
Is it 49ers Seahawks?
Oh, nope. Vikings Seahawks. Vikings Seahawks at home. Let's get a repeat of that.
49ers Packers, actually. That was a really fun one.
Oh, my God. Wait, so all these teams have played, every iteration of the NFC Championship has played each other.
That does seem to check out, yes.
And really none of them, except for Seahawks 49ers.
Or, no,
the 49ers played the Packers.
Yeah.
The Seahawks played the Vikings.
Yeah, they all did. There you go.
Oh, boy. Well.
On that note.
I'm excited to just feel the emotions of another Seahawks game. There's There's nothing like it. This is it. This could be it for what we feel. Like, you don't, it is a privilege to be able to feel these feelings for another Sunday. And we hope it continues from beyond here. But if it doesn't, it's still been a fun season. And
my heart may not consider it a pleasure.
That's it. That's it. Look, we're not going to feel, no matter what happens, we will not feel this kind of stress until, like, I don't know.
Pac-12 tournament could produce similar stress.
In the war, you know.
Well. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.